This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Today, we'll speak with one of the most acclaimed young violinists on the scene, Benjamin Beilman. He has garnered praise as monstrously talented, a tone that has been gushed over as the sonic equivalent to dark chocolate, a future superstar of the violin, and his approach called Heifetz-like. Not bad for a young artist not even 30 years old. He studied and graduated from the Curtis Institute of Music, and you've heard him here on the Classical Network and concerts we've broadcast in the Emerging Artist series from Merkin Concert Hall in New York City with Alice Weiss as your host. His debut recording has been released on Warner Classics. It's called Spectrum, and we'll sample from that throughout the program. Music of Janacek, Stravinsky, Kreisler, and Schubert, that's my guest with pianist Yekwan Sunwoo, in the slow Andantino movement from Schubert's Violin Sonata in A, Deutschlisting 574, the Grand Duo. My guest will be soloist with the Philadelphia Orchestra next weekend. More about that at the end of the program. I met up with Benjamin Beilman at his Center City, Philadelphia apartment a few weeks back. Fittingly, he lives above a violin shop.
I am very happy to be here today. We've tried to make this happen a few times here with violinist Benjamin Beilman. And congrats on the fairly new recent CD, debut CD. It makes a nice statement. I want to sort of dwell on the CD here right at the beginning. Now, it's on Warner Classics. And the reason it's on Warner Classics, very nice company, but it's really just through corporate merger that all these other artists are now on Warner because it's sucked up EMI Classics and what used to be Angel and what used to be Erato and used to be Teldec. However, they are still on record the distributor of, it's like Perlman, Maxim Vengeroff, but you can keep going over generations, you know, Sarah Chang, Nigel Kennedy, Michael Rabin, you can go over this whole spectrum. There's a lot of great violinists on what is now Warner Classics.
Okay. Yeah.
Is that daunting? Is that an honor? I mean, how do you view the fact that you're on now is a major label in a time when major label has even changed its whole with, record stores and CDs, but that in fact you're part of this lineage now, you know. So
of course, if you think about it carefully, yes, it is absolutely daunting. Yeah. I think, you know, as you sort of research possible combinations of works for a CD, obviously you'll go back and you'll look online and you'll see that, oh, you know, actually Perlman recorded that in 1976 and he did this exact same thing, or these two concertos were played together. So yeah, of course you can't help but sort of almost compare yourself to them. But on a broader scale, all of the pieces that I love to play were written in the 1800s, 1900s, whatever. They're at least 100 years old, thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of violinists have played them before. So you could also be nervous or anxious about that track record. Yeah, it enters my mind, but it's not something that I lose sleep over.
Yeah, you just sort of have to say, well, you sort of make your step with the piece, but also the program. Did you have complete freedom to program anything you wanted for this debut?
I did. I was really fortunate. So Warner Classics came to me and they said, we're interested in recording you over a 3-disc deal, essentially. So the first album they were hoping would be a recital album. I said, that's great. I have a wonderful recital partner that I've collaborated with many, many times. We have a lot of different repertoire. And they said, great, do whatever you want, whatever you think is going to be the best statement of your playing right now. So I had the opportunity to choose all the pieces. And of course, you know, there's this idea, should you release a sort of a statement CD? Should you do something like all the Bach partitas or sonatas? You know, am I ready for that? And I said, no, that's something that I want to save for later on in my career and my life. But the four pieces that I chose first and foremost because I felt that they were the strongest pieces in my repertoire. I felt that I had sort of the most potent things to say through this music. But also the four pieces sort of joined together to be what I thought would be a good sort of portrait of where I am and sort of my own personal mission statement as a performer.
Yeah, because the four composers would not come as a quartet. Schubert, Janáček, Stravinsky, and Kreisler do not come together as four people you would name.
Definitely.
You did find common ground. I mean, besides the fact that they fit into your career right now and they show you in the strongest light, because that's the other question too, is what do you want people to get from this recording? But you did find some common ground here.
Yeah, well, I think so. Another thought that came into my mind when I was programming these pieces is, if I were to play this on a recital, would this work? And I thought, I often play many of these pieces together. Very often the Schubert and the Janáček, I find, are really great sort of balances between each other. Obviously, the lyricism of the Schubert draws out a lot of the lyrical elements in the Janáček, which might be overlooked at times. Right. You know, Janáček is a very powerful, aggressive piece at times. And I think often that's probably what listeners hear, just that. But obviously it's much more complex than that. So basically, when I was coming up with the program, I wanted things that would sort of draw the more subtle and nuanced elements out of the other pieces.
The one which might, despite his name being well known, especially with violinists, but the Kreisler isn't done that often. I mean, it's probably the piece on here that people might say, I don't know that piece, you know? So how'd you come across?
I came to the Viennese Rhapsodic Fantasietta by Kreisler through a former teacher of mine. I think I had a few sort of debut recitals coming up in New York and Philadelphia at the time. It was maybe 6 or 7 years ago. And my teacher at the time, Ida Kavafian, I was working with her at the Curtis Institute in Philadelphia. And she studied with Oskar Shumsky, who was a fantastic violinist who recorded, I believe, the complete Kreisler works. And she said, you know, you should really check this piece out. I love listening to my former teacher playing this. It has everything. In structure, it's essentially sort of two of his, you know, traditional sort of chestnut pieces bridged together by a short little interlude. But it ends in kind of the most unbelievable fashion. There's fireworks, there's octaves, there's arpeggios. I mean, everything that you can think of to excite a listener, Kreisler throws in there. For whatever reason, maybe it's because of the structure or just because it was written towards the end of his life and he maybe didn't play it as often, it's not so well known, but to me, it's a total masterwork.
Because this is really an old model that Warner's working with, sort of signed the artist for a multi-disc type of thing. That used to be the case 25 years ago. So as these other two CDs, which you're going to have to do for them, come on, are you also going to have sort of freedom there? Do they want you to get in front of an orchestra? I mean, how does this play out these days? Because it's got to be very different than it was in 1985.
Absolutely. I think this is just conjecture, because I don't know what the business was like back in the 80s, but I do get the sense that Warner in particular, they want to sign artists who have their own concept and their own voice already at least beginning to develop And I think they want to give each of these artists lots of leeway to sort of explore what they want. So yes, this first CD, they basically gave me carte blanche. They just said, violin and piano, program what you want, what you think is important. For the next CD, the date of the recording is still sort of being determined, but it'll be a concerto disc with the Sibelius Concerto and Szymanowski's First Violin Concerto.
Okay.
And both of those pieces were my pick. Essentially, they said, come to us with your repertoire ideas. Let's think about what would be good for you right now, and we'll help pair you with good orchestras and conductors, and we'll make it work.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's very accommodating.
Yeah.
Once again, from my guest, Benjamin Baumann's debut CD on the Warner Classics label called Spectrum, this is the first movement from Czech composer Leos Janáček's violin sonata, Jakwan Sonwu on piano. Thank you.
A little bit about you. I mean, how young did you start playing? You're from where?
I moved around quite a bit growing up. So I was born in Washington, D.C., but I only lived there for 8 months. Yeah. My family moved to Houston shortly after that, and that's where I first began my violin studies at the age of 5. I took up violin because I have an older sister, Elizabeth, who's 2 years my senior, and she started violin lessons through her school when she was 5, and, you know, it was a nice Suzuki group class as well as private lessons. And so, you know, I was 3 at the time. My mom would bring both of us to my sister's lessons. I would just sort of sit on the floor, play around with whatever toy I had while my sister was studying. And then, of course, you know, at that age, you emulate and you look up to your older siblings so much. And I just said, yeah, I want to do this too. This looks cool. So at 5, I asked if I could have my own violin.
Right. So lessons, moving up. At some point, you've got to either be mentored or advised or say, I'm going to do a solo career. I don't know when that came for you. You can tell us where it came for you. But I'm just wondering, take us through that process, because there's got to be an awful lot of confidence. We talked at the beginning how you're releasing a record with all this great lineage of violinists, you know, on the label. Where did that point come for you? And was it a confident, yes, I'm going to do this? Was it somebody pushing you and say, you should do this?
That moment for me came when I was, I forget if I was 10 or 11. I think I was 10. But I just sort of, you know, from the age of 5, our mom was very, very good about practicing with us and sort of keeping us on track. You know, as a 5, 6, 7-year-old, obviously you want to play outside with your friends all the time. But my mom was very good about saying, okay, you can do that, of course. But first practice for 20 minutes or 30 minutes or whatever it was that I was doing. And then you can do whatever you want. Then you have your free time. And by the time I was 9 or 10, I really came to sort of understand that I was good at this. I was better than people my age, and I was enjoying it a lot. You know, the thrill of performing at that age was already there for me. And so when I was 10, I just said, you know, I like this. I think I can make a living out of it, and I'm good at it. I'll give it a shot. I think I want to be a professional. In the back of my head, obviously, there was a certain sense that, you know, you're 10 years old. What's the worst that could happen if you devote yourself to this? By the time you're 17, if you really hate it or if it's not working out, great. You apply to normal college and you have a different career path. But it really worked out for me.
But professional just means you're going to play and get paid. You have to make some point in your studies that you're going to have a solo career and not sit first, second violin in some orchestra or be in a string quartet. I mean, where does that come in? Because I always found that a strange point in somebody's life that they're going to say, I'm going to have a solo career.
Yeah, oh, no, of course. My training, you know, from the time I was maybe 12 or 13 was really specifically just solely about solo repertoire. You know, the big concertos, big sonatas, some show pieces, Paganini caprices, things like that. Mm. I actually think that that sort of track is very common for most young instrumentalists, this idea that you should build up your technique and your abilities through the most demanding repertoire. And then when your adult life comes, you can really decide what actually is what makes you happiest. You know, maybe it could be chamber music, branch out into Beethoven quartets, into Dvorak, or whatever. But for me, it was sort of just a pretty singular focus in solo repertoire. I will say, though, that one of the, actually probably the most life-changing musical experiences for me was when I attended the Marlborough Music Festival up in Vermont. I was 17 when I first went, and for those of you who don't know, it's essentially, it's the sort of the mecca of the chamber music world. You're placed in groups alongside some of these great masters. It's not a chamber music festival where you're coached, you know, sort of from above. You learn by having, you know, members of the Juilliard Quartet or whatever major ensemble sitting as your second violinist or your cellist, or, you know, you might have Mitsuko Uchida playing the piano part in a Dvorak piano quintet. So that was a pretty inspiring summer for me. I went back 4 summers in total, but that was the time when I sort of combined my technical prowess with, you know, getting more in touch with what you should be saying with your personality or your soul or your mind, essentially.
But not every instrumentalist, not every violinist in your case, does a solo career and is successful at a solo career. So, I mean, is it a matter of confidence in yourself? Is it strictly a matter of talent that can separate the concert violinist from mainly, as you remember, rather than taking an orchestra job or something like that? I mean, to me, it would seem confidence, right? That you're just perfectly sure of yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I think
failures do come along the way. I mean, there's setbacks and things like that. So,
yep, most definitely. Confidence, I think, is a good word, but I think it's more about sort of confidence and comfort in what you're doing. You know, for me, I get the greatest rush from being a soloist in front of an orchestra. That is where I feel most at home. That's where I feel like I can be most expressive. Similarly, you know, my sister is still a professional musician. She switched from violin to viola in high school. And for her, her biggest rush and her most satisfying musical experience is, you know, really delivering as a leader of an orchestra and also in chamber music. You know, for her, the idea of playing a concerto is obviously great, but her skill set and her interests are best served in a different type of performance. And similarly, I have classmates from Curtis who say, you know, playing a late Beethoven string quartet for them is just the top musical experience they could imagine. They wouldn't want to play a Saint-Saëns concerto or something.
Right.
It really is up to, I don't know, I guess, are you a thrill seeker? Are you a more introverted musician? I mean, it really depends.
It's always fascinating to see the path people take, you know.
So here is the Fritz Kreisler Viennese Rhapsodic Fantasietta from my guest's debut CD on Warner Classics, Yekwan Sunwoo on piano, my guest Benjamin Beilman on violin.
But even as far back as when you were 20, so almost a decade, you've had, you know, a lot of great reviews for your performances, and a lot of, you know, adjectives that some of these critics throw out, especially about your tone. I love the dark chocolate, okay, but also violent. And I mean, when you read these, whether you have give them any credence or not, but these are people that have heard a lot of violinists, right? Some of these critics, so they're trying to describe your tone. Do you find some of these actually line up with exactly what you think your tone is? I mean, how much reality is there between what people will read about your sound and what you play? Because you're trying to create a sound that is you. And what actually is, or does it change? I mean, do you read some of those reviews from 7, 8 years ago and go, well, it's not who I am today, type of thing? I mean,
yeah. The piece of advice that I was given fairly early on was, if you believe one review, then you have to believe all of them. So if you get a good review, obviously it feels great, but if you get a bad review, then you have to believe it just as much as a good one. So yes, it's interesting to hear one person's perspective on your performance, but I, as much as possible, I try not to put too much emphasis in it. You know, the unfortunate thing about some of these reviews is sometimes, you know, you go to an orchestra and you're playing with them for the first time. In some of these cities, you have no one that you know who is in the audience. Right. So you can't talk to any of your trusted friends about how they think that you did. And sort of the most permanent token that you have from that performance is a review. And if it's a bad review, then you begin to question, you know, well, I thought that, you know, on stage it felt really good and I had a great connection with the conductor and the orchestra. And how could it be that somebody in the audience really was so turned off by the performance? So I think it's a necessary part of the concert experience. I think obviously reviews exist for people who both attended the concert to maybe understand it in a different way, for people who didn't attend the concert to sort of get a sense of what happened that night. And also, you know, as much as it pains me to say it, it may be an opportunity for the reviewer to sort of spur the performer onto higher heights.
Sure. And if they're reviewing the performance of the piece, sometimes you might not have some of that under your control. It could be the orchestra, it could be the conductor, if it's a concerto. But I'm talking about, so when they sort of describe, like, your tone and things like that, I mean, do you find that you go, oh, this person really nailed it? Because they might talk about the performance, but they're also trying to describe you as an artist and the sound you get out of this violin. I'm just curious about whether you think, is that accurate? I mean, is Dark Chocolate and Violent accurate here in your late 20s? Because those were written about you when you were 20.
Yeah, no, I look at it more through the lens of the piece. If they say that, you know, oh, my tone was violent or muscular, whatever adjective they use, then I hope that it's appropriate for the piece. I think I seem to remember that one of those reviews was from a performance of the Kodai duo for violin and cello, which to me is, it should have some muscularity to it. It's a very powerful and intense piece, and I think Kodai wanted to project this sort of persona of almost, you know, two titans competing with each other. Right. So in that instance, yeah, I say, yes, I'm glad that the reviewer heard that. That's exactly what I was going for. The tone element, it's always nice if somebody says that you have a, you know, whatever, a chocolatey tone. You know, obviously that's some sort of compliment. The sort of skeptical side of me says, oh, maybe the reviewer was responding to, you know, a line in my bio about what violin I was playing. I think at the time I was playing a Guarneri del Gesù. Yeah. And obviously it's nice to have, but again, you can't put too much emphasis on it.
Like I said, it doesn't always line up with how you were viewing your tone at the time. It seems like, when we talked at the beginning about being on Warner with all these great violinists, it seems like, and I could be wrong on this, that you do have a sense of your instrument, the heritage, the lineage, where these lines trace. Is that true? And if so, how does that color how you play, what you pick to play? I mean, some violinists move heavily towards new music. They want to play new things for the violin. Some of them are, you know, just, well, that's the question. I mean, where does the lineage and heritage of your instrument factor in for you?
Yeah, it's definitely something that I am very aware of as I play each of the pieces. Like, for instance, when I was recording the Chrysler, it really hit me in the recording studio that at this point, you know, this piece was written in, I believe it was like 1940. I obviously was not around in 1940, nor did I ever have the chance to hear Fritz Chrysler play live.
Right.
And the performers from that generation are at the very twilight of their career or no longer with us. And so it really occurred to me that actually playing Fritz Chrysler should be sort of treated with the same sort of attention to detail and playing style as performing, you know, whatever, Bach or Vivaldi, this kind of performance practice. You know, playing Chrysler for me is a performance practice art. You know, I have to sort of listen to performers of his day, how they slide, how they use the bow, how they vibrate. And ideally, how I perform Chrysler should not be the same way that I perform Stravinsky or Schubert. I mean, in my mind, it should be noticeably different characters in playing styles.
So if you adjust your sound, your playing approach as per the composer, their context historically, do you strive to have your own identity?
Yes, exactly. You've hit it right on the head. I mean, obviously, at the very core of being a performer, you should have your own personality. So yeah. What I'm working on every day and what's a primary focus for me is how do you balance this idea of being authentic to the period while also maintaining your own persona. I think you can't help but bring your own personality into it, and obviously I'll have a certain consistency in certain colors and certain tones throughout whatever music I'm playing. But yeah, you're right. It is a decision and a dialogue that you have to establish.
Yeah.
Once more from my guest's debut CD on Warner Classics called Spectrum, music of Stravinsky, the Pas de Deux in three sections, Adagio, Variation, and Coda, from the Divertimento, music Stravinsky composed for orchestra, his work The Kiss of the Fairy, transcribed for violin and piano by Samuel Dushkin, performed by Yekwan Sunwoo on piano, and my guest today, violinist Benjamin Bielman. Thank you.
You've got a big gig coming up next week. We'll talk about that in a second. But, I mean, you're a young artist. You're under 30. A lot of your concerts, you're going to look out in that audience. And they could easily be your parents or grandparents, just because I'm talking about the age factor here. Do you consider the fact of trying to get younger ears into an audience of yours? Does it factor into what you're trying to do, the music you pick? Are you concerned about it? I mean, you look at some of these audiences, and it's a much older aged audience. It just is. I mean, there might be some people your age, but if you ask them to stand up, it would be very few. So, I mean, talk about the idea of getting audience members in your age bracket into concerts that you give.
I mean, that's the million-dollar question. Of course, yeah. I mean, that's definitely something that you have to consider. Will there be an audience for me in 20 years? Okay. I think the best thing that we can do right now is to do as much as we can to teach the young people, like, just anything about music. Even if they don't have an instrument in their hands, just giving them exposure to, you know, Schubert and these people who can speak directly to them, even though they live 200 years in the past. Something that, you know, I asked one of my former teachers the same question, and Christian Tetzlaff had a great answer, which is a different perspective, but still a hopeful one. He said, you know, I think the value of classical music is not always really apparent to people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. You know, at that age, you're getting to know so many different things, but later on in life, you begin to understand quality on a deeper level and value. Mm-hmm. And he said, I think it's natural for an older generation to be the ones that come to classical music. They're looking for something that is more moving and more deep than an experience that they had earlier. And so obviously, they would find that in Brahms and Schubert and Mozart.
Right.
So it's not necessarily a tragedy that most patrons of classical music are in their 50s, 60s, and 70s.
No, it's not, but yeah, healthy mix. I mean, you're right. I mean, most people in 20s and 40s, they're, you know, having heavy-duty relationships. They might be starting a family, maybe having kids. They're going through all these things that take a lot of mind space, a lot of processing, a lot of, and then they move past that, and they're looking for, they have time, for one. They're also looking for things that have a little more emotional range because their emotions have been hemmed in by things they're doing in life. And, you know, it's always been that way.
So I think what I can do to contribute to bringing young people in is just be as great of a performer as I can and excel at what I do and bring enthusiasm and, you know, hopefully create a concert experience that is memorable. That's my approach. I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, and I do try and be active in social media and all that stuff. But for me, my biggest goal right now is just to become as great of a performer as I possibly can.
Because other artists your age approach it, some, like I said, program new music heavily. They're connected with composers of this time. Some of them do all the outreach in the schools. I mean, it has to be a concern, though. I mean, you can approach it 5-10 years down the line. You've got the time to do that, luxury to do that. But, I mean, there has to be a concern that, you know, that the audience for programs that of your, and, you know, let's say next week you're going to be with the Philadelphia Orchestra. That's a big gig, you know, especially here in Philly. You went to Curtis and everything. Playing Prokofiev. Well, first of all, what does a gig like that mean for you? I mean, this is a pretty big deal.
Yannick's
on the podium. I mean, you got everybody there. So
absolutely. I mean, the Philadelphia Orchestra, to me, is one of the greatest orchestras in the world.
Sure.
And I had the great fortune to hear them just about every week when I was a student. The Philadelphia Orchestra would give Curtis students free tickets, but you were sitting up in the fourth tier. So I remember looking almost like a bird's eye view of the stage because you're way at the top just behind the orchestra. So every time I walk, or I shouldn't say every time, the times that I have walked on stage to perform with the Philadelphia Orchestra, I do feel that weight and that history of, you know, I know this sound intimately. Yeah. I know exactly what the strings sound like. You know, I know how great they can sound, and I know how great the soloists are that they bring in. So, of course, there is a certain, you know, pressure when you walk on stage. Actually, when I performed with the Philadelphia Orchestra for the first time in Kimmel, I think it was back in February of 2014 or 15, I forget. That was the first time that I've been nervous for a rehearsal. You know, occasionally I'll get nervous for performances, but for the rehearsal, that was the moment where it sort of hit me. Like, okay, this is the big stage. This is what I've been striving to achieve, and now I'm here, and I have to deliver.
That's what I was going to say. Is that pressure turned into nerves or adrenaline or a mix of both? Or, I mean,
a mix of both. I think what distinguishes a good soloist from a great soloist is, can you turn those nerves into a power or some sort of fuel for your own performances? And ideally, you can turn the adrenaline, the higher blood circulation, into, you know, extra awareness and extra excitement in your playing.
Right. and this might be a crazy question because you're just saying, I said Yannick's going to be on the podium. You know, he's one of the, obviously taking the Met gig too, he's one of the great conductors going right now, right? A lot of spotlights on him. And there shouldn't be any difference, but is there any difference playing with a maestro, with a concerto like this, who's, Yannick is closer to your age than he is to many of the people in the orchestra. Let's just put it bluntly like that. So he is of a generation that's closer to you. I mean, does it make any difference, or does it either surface or subsurface that you're playing with somebody, making music with somebody who's, you have a little bit more relative common ground with?
Yeah. What is more in my mind is he a sympathetic collaborator, sure. Which he most definitely is. He's probably the greatest conductor that I've worked with in terms of understanding exactly how you want to shape a piece and supporting you actively, not just passively. You know, very often you have conductors who just sort of say, oh, you know, I'll follow you, you lead the way. And that's really not how it should be. It should be the conductor is almost an equal partner in a concerto. So yes, what I'm struck by most is that he's the best collaborator, but also because he's a young guy and because he's fun to hang out with, obviously you can get maybe a little bit closer to him personally. In post-concert dinners or whatever. I performed with him up in Montreal, I think back in 2012, with his orchestra up there. And it was a different experience being able to go out with him to a really fun dinner. You know, it's different going out to dinner with somebody like him versus sort of an elder statesman conductor.
Right, sure. Yeah. So looking down the line, I mean, are there pieces, composers you haven't played yet, venues? I mean, if this was 10 years later and we were sitting here, I mean, what are your signposts? What are your things you've got in the career that you'd really like to get done, you know, that means something once they've happened?
Of course, you know, everybody has their own sort of personal ambitions and, you know, sort of like a top list of which orchestras and conductors I'd like to work with. Obviously, I have that. But what's more obvious in my mind is just an even greater fluency in how to convey something in pieces. I have composers that I really want to explore a lot more. Bartok, for instance. Mm-hmm. He wrote two fantastic violin and piano sonatas and a solo sonata that I really want to work on a lot more. Yeah. Some contemporary music. I have a couple commissioning projects that are coming up, and I'm sort of narrowing down the list of composers that really speak to me that are living today. Right. I do want to sort of establish a much firmer grasp of that. But, you know, on a broader scale, just sort of keep in balance with a personal life and a career, because often I look to a generation or two above me, and the performers that were really at their peak in their mid-20s or early 30s, often they really burn out because they haven't really figured out how to sort of nurture themselves in the non-performance days. You know, what do they do in their home? Or can they survive having downtime? Sadly, I have some friends who are unbelievable performers, but I see them booking themselves where they don't have a single day off, and you get the sense that if they let themselves rest for a bit, they'd sort of go crazy and they'd start to ponder the really tough questions that maybe they don't want to answer right now. So,
All the hems and haws of a career.
Yeah.
Well, we look forward to a heck of a lot more from you over the years, decades. I'm sure that's going to happen. I don't know if, you know, if you continue to be on Warner Classic. I don't know if it'll be on CDs, because we don't know the fate of these either. But, you know, at least you'll be around making music. I close all my cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. The first is a hypothetical, which says, if you could chat like we've been doing with someone from the past. To me, never had a chance to. But when I asked that question, what's the first name that popped into your head?
Well, because I've done recently a bit of research on Fritz Kreisler, I get the sense that he would be just a wonderful friend to have. I mean, obviously, he was such a gregarious personality, but he was such a benevolent guy, too. He has this great quote. I've read a couple biographies, and there's this great quote that he said. He said, artists are like bees. You travel from one city to the next, pollinating ideas from one to you know, the following city. And I like that image, that you're connecting people. You know, ultimately, it is this idea of communion, and you are in a unique position to connect people.
I don't know his biography deep enough. Did he ever teach? He sort of avoided that, didn't he?
I don't believe he had any full-time teaching position. He may have obviously listened to young players here and there, and he would help them along, but I don't think his skill set was necessarily about teaching somebody. You know, what's interesting is he was such a natural talent. He gave up the violin for 5 years or something. I think when he was like 16 or 17, he stopped playing. He was a bit of a wunderkind, you know, he had a great career. He was like the youngest prize winner at the Paris Conservatory. He could have had it all when he was 18, but he decided, maybe I'll study to be a doctor. I'll be in the army a little bit. And then he decided, no, actually, I really like music. And so when he was, I think he was like maybe 21 or 22, he got himself a room at a tavern outside of Vienna, and he just practiced all day long for 6 weeks, and he wrote some of his most famous sort of pieces during that time. And from that time on, he was just constantly performing at the highest level. I think his music and his performance came to him so naturally that he wouldn't be able to explain anything to a student. I don't think he could understand why they're struggling with a passage.
Yeah, no, that would make sense, like Paderewski or something like that, just natural talent type of thing. Final question is non-musical, besides going out with people like Yannick and everything, but I'm thinking, when you have to do something that is non-musical, take yourself away from it, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, a little respite, what do? If you need to get away for a while?
When I have more than about 2 or 3 days at home, I really enjoy cooking, kind of doing these like big, elaborate meals, you know, like 3 or 4 course meals. I'm not a great cook by any means, but I like the process of, you know, choosing the dishes, the ritual of going to the grocery store, picking it all up, doing all the prep work. It exercises a lot of the same skills that I use as a performer, you know, attention to detail, a little bit of improvisation when you're cooking, obviously. And, you know, you can bring people over and it feels good to share it with them. And, you know.
So your friends know this is like Ben's cooking tonight. So it's like,
yeah,
everybody over.
And actually, it's nice. There's a nice community of sort of Curtis alums or people connected to the Philly Orchestra that are living in Philly. And so there's a nice, you know, group to gather when people are in town if they feel like, you know, doing a big ornate thing.
Well, the cooking takes you away, but I'm sure the talk is music at the table for the most part.
Yeah, definitely.
Benjamin Bauman, thanks for taking some time.
Thank you.
Violinist Benjamin Bauman. We've been sampling all program from his debut CD on the Warner Classics label called Spectrum. You can check it out at warnerclassics.com. Find out more about my guest at his website, BenjaminBeilman, BEILMAN.com. He'll be soloist in the Violin Concerto No. 1 by Sergei Prokofiev with the Philadelphia Orchestra, led by their music director Yannick Nézet-Séguin, next weekend, with concerts next Thursday the 10th at 8 p.m., Friday the 11th at 2 p.m., and Saturday the 12th at 8 p.m., all in Verizon Hall at the Kimmel Center on Broad Street in Center City, Philadelphia. In addition to the Prokofiev, the concert is an all-Ravel affair with the Le Tombeau de Couperin and the complete Daphnis and Chloe Ballet, featuring our area's own Westminster Symphonic Choir, Joe Miller, director. For information and tickets, go to philorc.org. I'll leave you with yet one more track from my guest's debut CD, the closing Allegro Vivace from the piece we heard at the outset of the program, the Violin Sonata in A, Deutschlisting 574, the Grand Duo by Franz Schubert, once again Yekwan Sunwoo on piano, and my guest today, Benjamin Beilman on violin. As always, I'm glad you are in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you. And thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, and an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.